Coming up on TechNation, if it looks like a newborn baby and moves like one and sounds like one, well, it just might be Super Tory, the newborn simulator from Gamard Scientific. Jim Arquetto joins me to talk about Super Tory in detail. Then, speaking of what it takes to address complex engineering feats, Dr. Daniel Moat, the president of the National Academy of Engineering, joins me to talk about how everyone, one way or another, can be an engineer. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Whether we like it or not, we're living in the age of information. And like all change we didn't precisely ask for, can't control, and can't stop, we have to learn to make the best of it. That doesn't mean ignoring it. Even if you're willing to turn off your television set, cancel your Netflix, reduce your smartphone to the functionality of a last millennium cell, and swear off Google, you can't avoid the bad. And truly, does anyone really want to go back to driving from one store to the next to see if they have that item in stock? Want to start calling airlines for tickets, hotels for reservations, and scheduling all those things from our smartphones? Withdrawing from the information age isn't going to happen, and there's no bargain we can make to hold it back. The good things about it are just too good, and the downsides, they are more than the irritants of forgetting to charge your phone or your tablet. There are deeper impacts as a result of the age of information, and they're just below the surface. First and foremost is the glut of information swirling everywhere about the state of the world, the nation, and whatever. Speak with any three people, and they each have a different perception of the facts. I've actually done this ever since the Star Report, investigating the President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky episode. Each person somehow received, or mistakenly perceived, or transmuted in their minds the basic facts. Then each passed along their own version of the facts with great confidence, and that's how misinformation abounds. Add to this deliberately created misinformation, not what we used to call spin, which took the same facts but gave them a different interpretation. We are way beyond spin. Now misinformation is intentionally constructed and delivered as a fact, and then spin comes back into play and takes over from the bad facts. Horrors. How in heaven's name are we supposed to keep it all straight? Well, that's the point. Beyond bad facts, the less we are sure of any facts, the more vulnerable we are to manipulation. We can't change any of these folks, but we can take our own measures. For starters, we can consider the source. Considering the source isn't a popularity contest or one in which we just like their opinions. It's more, does the person or organization giving me this fact have a record of delivering correct facts? If a mistake is made, is it publicly acknowledged? Do they have a published policy about checking the facts? Are they in the business of actually trying to get me good information? And that's just a start. The next thing is our opinion filter. Am I listening to an opinion or a fact? Or is this some merging of opinion and fact? And remember, opinion is not a deeper analysis of the facts. It's great when it happens. Is this person giving me more facts that I also have every reason to believe are true, and I can now understand more in order to form my own opinion? Today we have arguments over the basic facts, and there's a cacophony of opinions based on divergent facts, not all of which can possibly be true. And we have some people simply adding accelerant to the media mess. You can do it. You can be smart about the information age. Remember, media today drives perception, not truth. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we'll talk about a true technology baby, Super Tori, an 8-pound lifelike newborn simulator used for training in neonatal care. I'll speak with Jim Archetto from Gamard Scientific, and we'll also hear from Super Tori herself. Next, we'll gain a perspective on what it takes to address complex engineering challenges, and it's not just traditional engineers. Dr. Daniel Moat, the president of the National Academy of Engineering, joins me to talk about who should be considered an engineer. Don't be surprised if it's you. We've spoken with Jim Archetto from Gamard Scientific before when we talked about their medical training simulators, Victoria and Hal. He's back with Super Tori, a newborn simulator who looks and acts just like a baby. Jim, welcome back to Tech Nation.
Hey, thanks, Mar. It's great to be here.
Well, the last time you were here, you told us about Victoria and Hal. Bring us up to date on Victoria and Hal.
Sure. Quite a bit has taken place with both Victoria and Hal. The newest innovation on Victoria is what are called interactive eyes. And physicians get so much information from a patient in nonverbal cues. So Victoria's eyes now are able to track the physician or the nurse as they approach. The eyes will actually move towards that caregiver.
So saying, you better take care of me.
Exactly. So the eyes are really the latest innovation on Victoria. Hal's gone through some innovations as well, and there have been some additions to the Hal product line, mostly for first responders and the military. So we're working very closely with those two groups to ensure that we have the right products to train those first responders.
Now, you're here today, and it looks like there's a real-life baby on our console here.
She does.
She's breathing. Mm-hmm. We have a new baby in our family, and this looks like a brand new baby.
Congratulations to you. And yes, she is a 40-week gestational newborn baby named Super Tori. And she does do quite a bit, much like a newborn baby does.
Well, the first thing a newborn baby does is cry.
They do. And so just like a newborn baby, Super Tori can cry as well.
That does sound like a baby.
It's very realistic. It's a recording, actually, of a newborn crying. And when you listen to that crying or some of the other sounds that she makes or even her movements, babies don't have many ways in which they can communicate with us as adults or their healthcare providers. So crying, grunting, clenching of fists, moving of the arms, shaking of the head, these are ways that babies communicate. And we've programmed many of these into Super Tori. And the caregivers will take clues from that and treat the baby accordingly.
Well, I notice her when she's sort of in this distress mode, her arms are going up sort of toward her chest or toward her head. And that's all she does.
That's correct. And as adults or even toddlers moving through childhood, our limbs can move in a variety of directions. But babies don't. And when they do experience stress, they contract and they pull everything very close. So you'll see her arms and legs just move up very close to her body. And then they'll get very rigid and stretch out and then contract once again. And again, that's a communication. And physicians and nurses are going to be looking for those movements that the baby will have.
So as opposed to an opportunistic and experiential, I've seen enough babies, I know what's going on, you can observe them right here with Super Tori.
Correct. And Super Tori, remember, is designed to train. So there are certain conditions that healthcare practitioners see routinely day after day after day. but there are other conditions they may not see. And that's when a simulator such as Super Torii becomes so important, because they'll get to practice these conditions over and over again. So, for example, the first few moments of birth are critical. And you may be familiar with the famous Apgar score. So
when
a baby's first born, they do these tests to ensure the baby's breathing and the right color. Well, that particular interval is critical. And what happens if the baby's not breathing or if the heart rate isn't correct? Super Torii actually has fully functional lungs that actually breathe, inhale, exhale. She can exhale CO2, and all of these can be measured. And
she exhales CO2.
She can exhale CO2.
So you're converting the oxygen we breathe into CO2 output.
Actually, we have a little trick. We have a CO2 canister that mixes with...
Oh, here's the technology. Right. But you program the CO2 canister
Correct.
Such that if it's the wrong level, too little, too much, or the right level, you can train the candidate on figuring out, here's a problem with the Apgar. Here's the score this baby should get.
Correct. And what do we do? So there's a term called intubation, where a small tube is placed into the baby's throat that allows breathing support. So what they could actually do then is whisk the baby directly to the intensive care unit. Without that capability of intubating that patient, they would have to treat the patient right there without the tools they may necessarily need. So that's where this becomes so critical, that lung functionality, that ability to exhale CO2. Super Torii can actually be treated in transport from the mother's bedside directly to the neonatal intensive care unit.
Are you able to intubate Super Torii, who's kind of sitting here and opening and closing her eyes, and she's doing, somebody take care of this poor baby.
Correct. In fact, if Super Torii were in respiratory distress right now, we could actually intubate her, put that small tube into her throat, assist with her breathing. We could put a mask on her and squeeze a small bag and help her breathe with that bag or that endotracheal tube.
So would that be like CPR?
Correct. And in fact, not only could we perform CPR on her, but she's all tablet controlled. So sitting in front of me is this tablet, and as you ask questions, I'm simply touching things on the screen. We could enable the CPR mode on this tablet. And what's important about that is certainly we can perform CPR on her, but it actually provides a report. So at the conclusion of this training exercise, the caregivers would actually get a report to see how well they did on the simulation of CPR. And that allows them to practice that CPR on a neonate, which they may not see very often in their careers. But they would know, yes, we're doing this properly. We're administering the right volume with that bag. We're administering the right pressure with that bag. And we're doing it at the right frequency.
And you're not doing it on a real baby.
And you're not doing it on a real baby. We could do that same testing with a real ventilator as well. So a true mechanical ventilator, if we don't have that, we could use that bag and mask or tube as I just described as well.
Well, you've got Super Torii on this nice white blanket kind of, and
do.
You've got your tablet here. And of course, in my mind, tablets aren't hooked up to babies.
Correct.
Although they're there taking pictures of them constantly.
Yes.
And Super Torii, there's no tether here. There's no cable in. This is all wirelessly remote.
It is. And what's fascinating about Super Torii as well, we've spent a lot of time talking about the clinical aspects of it. But let's talk about the technology for a moment. And she is all battery operated. So she will actually run for up to 8 hours on this single charge. And she'll do just what she's doing now. She's breathing. Her mouth is opening and closing. Her eyes are opening and closing. Arms are flexing and contracting.
Her
and
little legs are, just
legs
like a
well.
Newborn.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So she'll keep doing that, all battery controlled. You're right, she's not plugged into anything. And likewise, she's operated from this tablet that's sitting in front of me. How does the signal get there? It's all wirelessly controlled. So what's interesting about Super Torii, in addition to the clinical aspects, is she is at the intersection of all these technologies which we talk about all the time. Tablets, wireless, robotics, animatronics, clinical technology, battery. Super Torii is really the intersection of all of that in this one small 8-pound package the size of a newborn.
Well, you've got it all packed in a newborn.
We do.
I mean, this looks like a real baby. And I have to say, what happens with real animatronics, not the old, you know, click, click, click stuff we used to see in the old days, is that when you catch it out of the corner of your eye, or and in this case, you look straight at it, when you see the movement, you I can tell you that I'm physically reacting to, there's a real baby here. And I'm kind of putting my hand out. And,
right.
And so we're, the humanness is clear. But the fact that you could have all this technology in this baby, and frankly, I don't hear anything.
You don't. And we've spent a lot of time creating that because, as we described, babies don't communicate very well, or they have limited ways in communicating. So as you know, physicians and nurses are always trying to get information. They may be using stethoscopes or heart monitors or EKGs, and all of those electronics, were they not designed this way, could interfere either with normal audio clues, such as heart and lung sounds, or electronics, such as real EKGs and real defibrillators, which you can also use on SuperTory. So that's why you're right, Mara, the electronics have to be so precise that we don't hear them, and they don't provide any interference to other electronics.
And it's beyond electronics. I mean, usually when things move physically, mechanically, you hear things.
Yes.
You know, and I'm not hearing anything.
No, she has tiny servo motors that are designed to be very silent. And because of her size, there's not a lot of room for sound insulation. So that all had to go into the design up front in ensuring she maintained this level of realism.
Well, I was looking down this list here of all the various differential scenarios you could have with breathing.
Sure.
God love the APCAR, but that's a very rough estimate.
It is a rough estimate. It's rudimentary at best. And think of when that was developed so many years ago. Now we have tests, but the fundamentals of anatomy and physiology don't change. The baby comes out of a fluid-filled environment and suddenly is now in this air-filled environment, and the lungs instantly have to change from merely a pump moving fluid in and out, which is taking place in utero, to now fully functioning alveoli, converting oxygen in the air to energy for that baby. So there's a vital functionality right there. And that's what's so critical about those few moments of life. And SuperTory allows healthcare providers to practice that right at those critical moments.
You are listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jim Archetto, Vice President for Corporate Planning at Gamard Scientific, based in Miami. They've designed, manufactured, and marketed simulators for healthcare education for over 60 years. Today, we're talking about Gamard's newborn simulator, SuperTory, for training in neonatal care. And some of these things, these aren't critical, but they are totally applicable to brand new babies. For instance, one of the things you have here is urinary catheterization. So you can learn to catheterize a baby?
Exactly. Because what's taking place at that particular point is, you know, they're going to start right away. There are techniques now such as skin to skin. So when a baby's born, the baby will be placed right on the mother's skin to ensure that emotional and physical contact. Well, then the baby's going to start feeding. Well, what if there's a problem? What if the baby is not urinating properly? SuperTory does have capabilities to be catheterized. In addition, what if there are critical conditions that require an IV, for example? An IV can be started on SuperTory in a variety of places, including the scalp. Also, blood flow. We need to make sure that the baby's heart is working properly as well. So there's a functionality on SuperTory called capillary refill time. Is blood getting to the extremities, and is it flowing back to the heart? And so she has that capability to provide that information to the caregivers in the room. What about color? Is the baby jaundiced or cyanotic? We've heard about babies being blue or yellow when they're born. Likewise, she can simulate that condition. She can be blue or yellow, and that's a signal to the healthcare provider that we need to do something. If she's blue, she's not getting enough oxygen. We need to do something about that. If she's yellow, we need to get her under lights pretty quickly.
These scenarios, for instance, the blood flow out to the fingertips and back. In one of my sons, I have a series of pictures as he's born in the first minute, and you can just see he started out, he was blue at the end. And mm-hmm. then you can see as the heart starts beating, he's just, it goes pink right. to blue. But of course, he had a totally normal birth, yes. and he was totally normal at birth. So can we see that on Supertory if
we
there's
can.
A problem?
In fact, what I'm going to simulate now is what's called capillary refill time. So we want to be sure that blood is perfusing to her extremities. So what I'm going to do is squeeze her left foot. And as I do that,
quit hurting that baby.
You'll see
okay,
her left,
all right.
You'll see her left foot turn white. What I'm doing is squeezing the blood out of that left foot. And then what happens is the blood reperfuses. It turns back into a nice pink foot. So that tells the caregiver that, yes, blood's flowing. We've squeezed the blood out of the foot, but now it's flowing back. So we can do that with her in these extremities. And we can put real equipment on her as well. So let's say she was a little bit blue, as we described earlier. I could put a real pulse oximeter on her hand or on her foot, and let's actually measure her real oxygenation levels and make sure that oxygen is getting to her hands and feet as it should.
Now, of course, from that example, we're talking about a Caucasian baby, and,
sure.
and Supertory is very Caucasian.
Sure, yes.
What about the various races?
We do. In fact, this particular example of Supertory, as you described, is called light. We do have other shades as well. We simply call them medium and dark. And so that allows healthcare providers to, again, be very sensitive to that, because with melanin content in the skin, it's often more difficult to pick up these visual clues, such as cyanosis or capillary refill time or with pulse oximetry. So we mimic those conditions, those skin types as well for the clinical conditions.
Now we hear her crying, and of course we can also hear her grunting and doing all these things. Where's that coming from on Tori?
and we tried to keep that as consistent as possible because there are a lot of sounds taking place. We could put a stethoscope on her and hear actual heart and lung sounds. Well, what we've done is we've taken digital recordings of various heart, lung sounds, and babies crying and gruntings. And she is computer controlled, as we described. So in her chest there and abdomen, there are tiny speakers that create these heart, lung, and bowel sounds. She creates bowel sounds as well. And likewise, there is a speaker in her mouth that creates the crying and the grunting sounds from pre-recorded digital sound files.
First thing, every time a medical professional comes in, first thing, they've got their stethoscope out. They're listening. So that's the kind of sounds that you're giving off.
Correct. In fact, those sounds are pre-recorded in Supertory. I can change them on this tablet and make them more difficult for the physician or the nurse to hear. So they really have to work on it. And likewise, in a typical setting, if you've been in a delivery room, you know how much noise there is. You know how much interference. There may be overhead pages and alarms going off. They still need to hear these sounds. And so Supertory produces those sounds, but at the appropriate level for a newborn baby. So with the stethoscope, they can pick them up, but they're going to have to work for it just as they do in a real baby.
Now, I'm looking at Supertory here, and I'm having a little hard time believing all this stuff is inside her. What's inside her besides what you've described already?
Right. It is a combination. She does have lungs, as we've mentioned. So she is, as you see her chest rise and fall, she is inhaling and exhaling. If we were to peel her skin off, this realistic silicone
skin. You cruel man. It's very realistic.
It's very realistic. We would actually see the components, which are very robotic. So she is essentially under the skin, a functioning robot with motors and circuit boards and a battery and wires and cables that are making these arms and legs and mouth move and tiny speakers that make those sounds that we describe.
But I can still feel her joints, her ears. Her, I mean, everything yes. feels very real.
It's very important to provide those anatomical landmarks for healthcare providers because they need to know where things are. So, for example, if they – we talked about an IV earlier. If they're not able to find a vein to put that needle in, there's another type of injection called an intraosseous injection where they actually put a needle into the bone of her shin. So she actually has a realistic knee and shin, and based on those anatomic landmarks, they know exactly where to put this needle in. Well, you might not think of a bone as being very vascular, but it actually is, and it's a way to get fluid into the baby if there's no other way of doing it. So that's why those landmarks become very important. Likewise, in the scalp, we could actually provide an IV into veins in her scalp. So those landmarks have to be realistic. You may remember that a baby's skull is very soft when it's born, and the bony plates come together with gaps called fontanelles. And her fontanelle can actually expand, contract, because, again, healthcare providers are getting a lot of information from that. What are these bony landmarks doing, and what are these gaps doing on her scalp?
And how big is this? How big is this
Correct.
Gap?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things they check out.
Correct.
Now, I've always been a little freaked out when they just have the naked baby there. But of course, you have the classic little cap everybody puts on, and she's got a little diaper. And then I just noticed she has her umbilical cord.
She does have the umbilical cord, and that cord is functional as well. Because you really don't want to give a baby an IV if you don't need to, but you may need to take a blood sample to be sure that everything is okay. Well, with Super Tori, you can actually take a blood sample from that umbilical cord. There's a tiny reservoir with simulated blood, and they could actually draw blood from that umbilical cord. Likewise, that umbilical cord is still pulsatile, so they can actually check the baby's pulse very easily just by slightly squeezing on the clamped umbilical cord that you see here.
I think every baby should come with a tablet. I like that part.
It does make it much easier to
much
control
easier.
Them.
And I'm a little stunned. I'm stunned by the sense that it changes the whole educational pedagogy going on here. Usually it's like we talk to you a lot about it, and we may, and then it's like, okay, here's the baby. You got it. That's going to be your first one. And it's like it could be your sixth one after five tries at Super Tori, and you got it, and we have feedback. It just doesn't look okay. We have far more, even though it's a tablet, there's a lot of computation. There's a lot of data inside this tablet.
There is. And one of the key components of simulation is what's called the debriefing at the end of it. What went well, what didn't go well, and what can we learn from this? And this tablet tracks all of these components. So, for example, during our conversation today, we've made Tori cry. We've talked about capillary refill time. I've squeezed her foot. Every one of those actions is actually logged in this tablet. So the educator at the end of this training session can go back and say, at this time, here's what happened. Here's how you responded.
I'm speaking with Jim Archetto, Vice President for Corporate Planning for Gamard Scientific. We'll hear how Gamard got its surprising start after a break. Podcasts of TechNation, BioTechNation, and TechNation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, Dr. Daniel Mote, the president of the National Academy of Engineering. We'll find out exactly who should be considered an engineer. You may be surprised at the answer. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Jim Archetto from Gamard Scientific. We're talking about Gamard's newborn simulator, Supertory, used for training in neonatal care.
So, for example, during our conversation today, we've made Tori cry. We've talked about capillary refill time. I've squeezed her foot. Every one of those actions is actually logged in this tablet. So the educator at the end of this training session can go back and say, at this time, here's what happened. Here's how you responded. Now, with that crying, let's say Tori was also short of breath. Well, I could actually change her EKG or her heart rate or her respiratory rate or her blood pressure. We can change any of those parameters to see how the healthcare student responds to that. And then based on their interactions, all of that is recorded here, just as CPR is. And it's all time stamped. And now we have a true educational tool for these rare events that they can go back and check over and over and practice to be sure that they're doing it correctly. So when that real event takes place, I've done this before.
And that's that personal cycle, that experiential cycle that changes what you do and how you do it.
It sure does. And that being tracked allows you as the student and the learner to really review, because you're right, our memory isn't always as clear as we may believe it to be. But when you see it in the log that everything is documented and the baby had this condition at this time, you provided this treatment and here's how the baby responded, then all of that is clearly detailed in the log.
Now, as I recall, Gamard Scientific actually started decades ago, as you say, seven decades ago, and it was motivated by the battlefields of World War II. Tell us that story.
It's true. The company was founded by a physician from the UK named Dr. George Blaine. And when Dr. George Blaine was in World War II, he was deployed to North Africa. And what he found when he was with his troops, certainly interacting with the locals, was there was a very high incidence of maternal death and neonatal death. And so he started thinking about this after he trained his troops, and he kept thinking about this. What could he do? So he developed a very rudimentary trainer just to show people how babies were born. No one really knew at that point in that population. So what he did was he created a pelvis, but the front, there was no front on the pelvis. And he showed how the baby sat in the pelvis and then actually pushed the baby through the birth canal and showed how a baby was born.
And we're familiar with that today. I mean, how that's demonstrated, but they didn't exist then.
Did not. So that was really
It was a mystery
foundation.
How that baby got out of you.
It really was. And so now we still have a good portion of our business that are actually these pelvic birthing simulators and trainers, because nurses, midwives, even we want to know how are babies born, how are they delivered. So you don't necessarily need Victoria, but when students want to practice, they can go into a skills lab at their school and practice delivering a baby over and over, because it's not the routine deliveries where the problem comes in, Moira. It's those exceptional deliveries. It's those challenges. What if the baby's shoulder gets stuck on the mom's pelvis?
Yeah.
Now what are you going to do? That's a clinical condition called shoulder dystocia. What if the baby's reversed, a breech delivery? What are you going to do? What if the baby's head is facing the wrong way? You know, it's not facing the way it's supposed to. What are you going to do? So now students can practice all of that while they're on site in school over and over. Routine deliveries, they happen, no problem. Nature takes care of that. But we need to intervene where it doesn't go that way. And if you ask a physician or a nurse, how many times have you seen a shoulder dystocia in your career? Two. Out of all the babies
you've
delivered.
And you better be ready.
And you better be ready, exactly. Because from the time that's identified, there are five critical minutes, and that's it. There is no more time. So you better be ready, and you better be prepared for it.
Now, so much of this is new. Some of it's newer and older. We keep building on the shoulders of the previous technology. And it seems to me with some of these certifications we're looking for people to get, it's always a little hard to argue. And we have to make sure they at least have so much simulation time. We're used to it with pilots and simulators. What's that relationship today between this technology that's coming forward and certification?
There's a key correlation between practice and performance in a clinical setting. The old model was, if you were a physician, for example, during your residency, you would perform procedures on patients while the attending physician or the instructing physician was observing. Well, times have changed quite a bit now, and we can't do that. There are certainly litigious components. There are privacy components. But that practice still needs to take place. So recently, a study was published, and from a nursing standpoint, up to 50% of a nurse's clinical time now can be supplemented by simulation. So in order to get a license, a nurse can spend 50% of that time with a simulator recreating those clinical conditions. And with the shortage of patients due to the privacy issues that we've described and patient consent issues, how else will they get this practice? Simulation fills that gap.
Yes, I'm going to consent to you. I'm the one with the problem, and I'm going to consent to you trying it out on me. I don't think so.
Exactly.
Not so much. Mm-hmm. Not so much. We actually haven't talked about such things as pulse and heartbeat. And as I was thinking about that, all of this interface is in English. So can you do pulse and heartbeat and all that? And can you do it in a language other than English?
Certainly. There are language conversions, of course. With our adult simulator line, we can actually have the adults speak in other languages. So there are text.
We? No.
Exactly. The Supertory isn't really speaking in a language, so we don't worry about that so much. But certainly there is translation that's very easy to do in the software. When we talk about how the healthcare providers, nurses, physicians, first responders get information from the baby, we talked about the sounds from the stethoscope or the bag or the monitors, the real monitors that they can put on Supertory, whether it's EKG or a pulse oximeter. But they can actually get tactile response as well. So it's very common to walk up to a patient and feel their wrist or their neck for a pulse. Very similar with Supertory. She has pulse points as well. So they could feel a pulse just like in a normal baby. And also remember that umbilical cord still has a pulse as well. So they can feel a pulse in that umbilical cord. And either using a stethoscope or a heart monitor, they can hear those heart and they can get those heart and lung sounds and get that information. And she actually hooks up to real equipment. What if her heart stops beating? So babies do have heart problems. If her heart stops beating, she can actually be defibrillated with a real defibrillator. So a real energy-producing defibrillator can be used to restart her heart.
And the tablet over here and the computer and storage within it can record how well that went.
Absolutely. In fact, you can actually watch her heart rhythm on a screen here on this tablet or a monitor in the patient's room, and you can actually watch that heart rhythm convert from an arrhythmia to a normal heart rhythm. And you can watch it instantly, and you can see it logged in the tablet.
Jim Arquetto is the Vice President for Corporate Planning for Gamard Scientific, based in Miami. They've designed, manufactured, and marketed simulators for healthcare education for over 60 years. We've been talking about Supertory, Gamard's newborn simulator used for training in neonatal care. Complex engineering challenges, such as creating the remarkable Supertory, requires many people, many different kinds of expertise, and a depth and breadth of experience. From one perspective, all the people who participated should be considered engineers. Dr. Daniel Mote is the president of the National Academy of Engineering.
Everybody does engineering, actually. If you go back in history, the Neanderthals did engineering long before they had heard of science or biology or anything else. So because the earliest people and prehistoric people created solutions to their problems in various ways. Not as fancy, of course, as today, but the process of solving problems is very engineering-like, necessary. And it's everywhere in our society. The reason people are so confused about engineering is that it's such a big topic. It covers so many domains, from health sciences to hard sciences to social sciences to engineering to economy, agriculture, so forth. It's a ubiquitous topic. And most people know one or two people in this domain, and they think all of engineering is that. But it's only a small part of that.
Well, you can look down the list and know you really need to have a lot of different capabilities that no single person or even almost like a group could have. I mean, restore and improve urban infrastructure.
Urban infrastructure, for example, varies from place to place. You have very, very difficult circumstances in some communities. Let's say in India and South America, you have very crowded and complicated and devastated in many ways urban infrastructures that need to be repaired. You have people urbanizing at a very high rate. About 80% of the world's population will be in cities. For example, by 2040, that infrastructure has to be built. It has to be secure. It has to be safe, and so forth. And there has to be schools. There has to be hospitals. There has to be all the amenities that go into these infrastructures as well. So when you start talking about their urban infrastructure for the planet, you're talking about a lot of big problems, big expensive problems. And that's a big engineering space. That's one of the grand challenges for engineering.
Well, let's be clear. Engineering did achieve a lot in the last century.
Indeed, indeed. Well, this whole idea got started because of that. At the end of the 20th century, some people had the idea that they really should look at what engineering did in the 20th century and what kind of values did it have. How did it change the 20th century? So they got together a group and they tried to identify and did identify what they thought, at least, were the 20 greatest achievements of the 20th century. And they ranked them in order and then wrote a book about these 20 greatest achievements, ranking them in order and laid them out. Like the first one in the 20th century was electrification of the country. That is essentially expanding the electric grid around the United States for farms and people and businesses and cities and so forth. And that connected the country together and provided huge opportunities for personal growth and business development and so forth. Second one was the creation of the automobile. Third one was airplane. Fourth one was water distribution system for the country. And then, of course, number 11 was creating the interstate highway system. Number 13 was creating the internet. Number 19 was creating nuclear energy. Number 20 was advanced materials. So anyway, so...
I'm very impressed you can remember all the numbers.
No. It was a huge list. And when you look at it, you're so blown away by these... In just 100 years, all these things were created and implemented in our society. It was very U.S.-centric, but still the world benefited from all these as well. You know, the National Academy of Engineering has many members who have no engineering degrees at all. In fact, probably only half of the council have a degree in engineering, as a matter of fact. In fact, we have members with no degrees in anything, so many of them, as a matter of fact. And the reason... that's the case is that you don't get elected to the academy by what you studied or what you call yourself. You get elected by what you've done.
Oh, a little rubber meets the road here.
It's not a bad idea when you stop and think about it. Yeah. So at the end of that experience of creating these 20 greatest achievements of the 20th century, you looked at these and to tell you the truth, the people in the academy were just kind of blown away by this thing. Wow. Then the next question, you can just hear it coming. They say, well, what about the 21st century? What is engineering going to create in the 21st century? It's something like winning the national basketball championship if you're a university. The first question you get when they hand you the trophy is, well, what about next year? Are you going to win it again? Well, it's the same thing here. That was really great for the 20th century. What about the 21st century?
What are you going to do for this century?
What are you going to do for this century? So another committee was formed, and it started looking into this, and they realized it wasn't possible to predict what engineering would do in the 21st century. You can't predict 5 years from now, let alone 100 years from now. But they could ask a different question. Instead of predicting what it's going to do, maybe they could suggest what it needs to do. What does it need to do for people in society? Because engineering creates solutions for people in society. Okay, what does it need to do for people in society? And they started to approach the question from that direction. And then, of course, the next question is, okay, we'll do that. We'll find what it needs to do for society. But then the question is, needs to do what? What are you going to do for the people in society? I mean, there are lots of possibilities. It could be environment. It could be health. It could be economic development, jobs, and so forth. So once you start to ask the what question, what is it going to do, then the committee went back to a more fundamental view of engineering, and it said, what is it really going to do for the people on the planet that needs to be delivered to them, for the people on the planet? It switched the view from things like airplanes, automobiles, internet, and so
light bulbs.
Forth. Light bulbs. all the things in the 20th century that were so fascinating and important, to what the people need in the 21st century. So it's all of a sudden switched its view to be about people. Now, this happened in about a five-year period. 20th Century Report was published in 2003. This report was 2008. And they approached it from that standpoint, and that led to the grand challenges. These 14 grand challenges are challenges that really are to facilitate this vision for people in society, that is, continuation of life on the planet, making our world more sustainable, secure, healthy, and joyful. So these four criteria, sustainability, security, health, and joy of living, or joyful, are what's going to be delivered for people in this century when these grand challenges are satisfied all over the planet, by the way.
I think what's also important to understand is if you're working on a product, you're working on a product.
Right.
If you're working on a vision or a goal that says, if this is satisfied, then we've achieved it.
Right.
Any number of products might.
Lots of them.
This is the substantive change.
Right. There will be lots of them, as a matter of fact. And they'll vary from place to place. There's not just one solution. So some of these are local, and a lot of these are distributed all over the planet. But it brings everybody in the planet together on this thing. There isn't one country, there isn't one population that cannot benefit from these grand challenges. So you might say everybody's in the tent here. Everybody has an opportunity to participate in this and to benefit from it. There are no losers. There are only winners. It's the only example I can think of for an international vision where there are no losers, only winners, and everybody can participate in it to the extent they're able to. It's very exciting, as a matter of fact.
It also reminds me of a Silicon Valley approach to engineering that we have, and that says everybody on the team has to understand everything, whether it's where the company's going, where the project's going,
right,
where the global landscape is going,
right,
what the impact on the world is going, even though you have a very small part. In the old days, you just did your very small part.
That's right.
Now you look at all of this. So it seems to me if everyone, not just engineers, are looking at these grand challenges,
right,
something falls out of the fact that everybody has it in the back of their mind.
That's right. Exactly. Everybody has it in their mind, and they'll come up against it now and then, and they'll have a breakthrough idea. All of them, wow, why didn't I think of this sooner? We could do this, or we could contribute here. So I'm spending a lot of my time actually going all over the planet talking about this to different countries, different people, colleges, universities around the United States, and so forth. Right now we have about a good fraction, about 40 colleges and universities in the United States are signed up for this program. Another 40 are in the process of signing up for it as well. I'm looking to have about 150, about half the colleges and universities engineering in the United States here.
And then you'll do the rest after you're done with that.
Yeah.
I know how you work.
But I have to say one thing. This is an important point for people to understand. I was just at the University of Arizona last week or week before, talked about this. And people there got very excited, and they're going to create a Grand Challenges program for the entire university, not just for engineering. It's going to be for humanities, social sciences, graduate students, undergraduate students, medical school, and so on.
What people have to understand here is that this doesn't change, per se, any of the programs that are in place. It, in fact, makes sure that students studying in these programs, undergraduate, graduate, are looking at a sort of a complete picture. Describe the elements that would go into a Grand Challenge Scholar program.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So just a little preamble to this. The trick here, the need here, shall we say, was to create a program that everybody could adopt. And not only everybody in the United States, but everybody around the planet, whether in Bangladesh or Africa or China, U.S., wherever. educators will realize how difficult this is. It's very difficult for one university to adopt a program from another university, even in the United States, even if it's across the street. Same culture, same everything. Except it just doesn't happen.
It's not happening.
It doesn't
happen.
I'm telling you. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. So how could you create a program that would actually be accepted enthusiastically by everybody on the earth? Okay. So it seems like it's impossible.
You want to run for emperor? This could work out.
It's pretty close to impossible, right?
Yeah.
But the reason it works and is working well is that it's not a program in a traditional sense. So you don't try to change anybody's program. In fact, you don't mess with anybody's program. Everybody's in charge of their own program. What it does, it identifies five competencies that a student needs to get. And if the university or college says yes, they will agree to delivering these five competencies for their students in their program, then they become a Grand Challenge Scholarship program. And it's up to the university or college to choose the students. It's up to the university or college to choose how they're going to deliver these competencies to those students. And it's up to that university or college to declare that they have achieved them or not. So it's all left in the hands of the college or university. And that means that can work in Hong Kong or Africa or something. Because you're not telling them how to do it. You're just telling what the outcome needs to be, what kind of strength. And they decide whether they get it or not. And these five points are very critical points for the Grand Challenge's vision. And what are the vision pieces for this? And let me tell you what the five points are. One of them is students need to have some technical mentored experience on a project around a Grand Challenge-like topic, one of these big global multidisciplinary topics.
Hands-on.
Hands-on. Hands-on. Hands-on is important. Very good point. The second piece would be multicultural. Multicultural is very important. This is a problem for most Americans. We tend to think everybody uses solutions that work in America, but that's not even close to correct. There are so many examples. And so in other words, if the students are going to create a solution to a Grand Challenge problem, one of the focus's problems, and that solution is going to be implemented in another culture, in another country, another part of the world, it has to fit and be useful in that part of the world. It has to fit their culture. And most young people, in fact, don't have this idea. They just think in terms of American culture, local communities, so on, not in terms of where it's going to be implemented. In fact, when I told the president of Boeing about this, the first thing he said to me, I want all my employees to take this get into this program because we have this problem all the time. I'll give you one example on this if we have time for that. Just one example. I talked to a friend of mine at NIH, National Institutes of Health, about this maybe 3 weeks ago. And he said to me, we just have this problem. I said, well, his name is Rod Pettigrew, by the way. He's a very good friend of mine. I said to him, well, what was the problem? He said, well, we were trying to help people in Africa in villages to protect them from the Zika virus by keeping mosquitoes off them at night and giving them netting they could sleep in so the mosquitoes wouldn't bite them at night and transmit this virus to them. So we thought that was a good idea, and we went forward and bought all this beautiful netting for them and brought this netting to the villages, and so they could use it and protect them at night. And sometime later, I don't know, a month, weeks, something later, someone went back to the village to see how things were going, and they noticed that nobody was using the netting. Nobody. And they were surprised, of course, because they made a big effort to get the netting there and so forth to help them, and no one was using it. Well, it turned out the netting was white in color. Now, that didn't register with me. But in Africa and in many parts of the world, white netting is what is used to put dead bodies in. So people sleeping into white netting was like pronouncing they're dead, or maybe other people would think they're dead already. And so no one wanted to get into this white netting. Of course, they changed the color, and of course it was fine. Then they used it. So it's a cultural issue. They didn't understand this cultural issue about what white netting means. It's like giving white roses to someone from East Asia. That's also not a good idea for the same reason. So the cultural understanding is important, and the sooner the students get this idea, how important it is, the better. So that's the second one. Third one, multidisciplinarity. All these problems have multiple disciplines in them. They're not just
technical disciplines.
Not just technical. No, they're social, they're political,
language,
dealing with government,
literacy,
all kinds of things. I mean, they have religious issues. And so you have to understand that all of these problems are going to be very multidisciplinary, and you have to be prepared for it. And you can't consider it a burden. It's kind of the way things are. The fourth issue would be what I call viable business. When you create a solution to this problem, you have to be thinking all the time whether there is going to be a viable business for this solution in the place you want it implemented. And that'll vary about in the place, depending on how much resource it has and what the likelihood to use it and so on. So you have to have a viable business model in your mind all the time. And the fifth thing is what we call social consciousness. You have to have in your mind you're doing this to help people and society. This is not just to make money. This is about helping people in society. And so you have to have that understanding and appreciate that understanding. So those are the five pieces. Basically, it's a talent piece. It's about multiculturalism, multidisciplinarity, viable business, and basically social consciousness. And by the way, once they complete the program, the university tells us, well, these students have successfully completed the program of the competencies and so forth. They get a certificate from the National Academy of Engineering, signed by me. They also get a personal letter from me congratulating them for being Grand Challenge
Scholars. Let's hope you're totally taken up with signing.
Yeah, exactly.
So this would be a good result.
Well, we have computers. We can work this out. But I think the idea is important. So we're still in the attractor phase on this to see how far this will go. But you can't think of many programs right now that have been around for, let's say, from 9 years now, never had any funds from government, never had any funds from private sector, never had any funds from industry or foundations. But it's expanding in the United States, expanding around the world, all at the same time. So there's something here that people find very attractive. And I should also add that about half of the students, or maybe a little more than half of the students, are females, where if you look at engineering, only about 18-19% of students in engineering are females. So it's attractive to females, probably more on average than men. I think the males seem like to blow things up, and females seem like to help people in society.
But for you guys, this is a good place to meet women. Just wanted to point that out.
That's a very good thought.
My guest today is Dr. Daniel Mote, the president of the National Academy of Engineering. More information about the 14 Grand Challenges and the Grand Challenge Scholars Program can be found on the web at nae.edu. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.